It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello and welcome to Happy Horror Time. I'm Matt Emmert.
And I'm Tim Murdoch. And if you're a fan of the Halloween series, and who isn't, then you definitely know today's guest. She played final girl Kara Strode, the adopted cousin of Laurie Strode, who fights Michael Myers in the 1995 sequel, Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers. No stranger to the horror genre, she also starred in such films as Steakland, Breadcrumbs, and Last Kind Words. Please welcome to the podcast, author and actor on stage, TV, and the big screen, Marianne Hagan. Woo!
Hi.
How are you?
How are you? We are so excited to have you on.
Yes.
I'm so excited to be here.
That is awesome. You know, before we even jump into anything Halloween or horror related, I read that you grew up in New York City and graduated with a BA in political science from Duke University. How did that lead to a career in acting?
Okay. Well, first of all, I grew up in Westchester County.
I was
born in the Bronx, and like when I was 6 months old, my family moved to Westchester County. So that's where I grew up. But I grew up in a family that had absolutely zero connections to quote unquote show business. So the idea that someone might choose acting as a career was just the most insane concept ever. So it wasn't even a thing. Like, I wasn't a child actor. I didn't like go to like, you know, musical theater camp and stuff like that. I was just a student, you know, but my dad did get us into the city to see all the big Broadway shows. And that was always just very magical.
Yeah.
And then while at Duke, just on a whim, I took an acting class and kind of fell in love. And then my junior year, there was a notice up for auditions for the, you know, the fall show, and it was Jean Anouilh's Ring Around the Moon. So I was in the library, and instead of doing my work, I went and I found a copy of the play and I read the play. And I was like, I could play Countess Diana. I could do that with my eyes closed and my sleep. So I went to the audition and I got it.
Okay. Awesome.
Folks, and I wasn't a drama major, so it was like kind of a scandal. It was a little bit of a scandal because really technically only drama majors could be in the main stage plays. But the director, who was from New York City and wasn't a professor at Duke, said, I don't care, I want her. But after being in that show, I was just completely bitten by the acting bug. And my senior year, I applied to all these journalism schools because that was the path I was supposed to be on. And I was going to go to Columbia. And I said to my parents, I want to pursue acting. This is what thrills me. This is what gives me a life force. And they
good
said,
for you.
Yeah.
Good
they
for
said, you. Okay, well, I could defer Columbia. I could defer the acceptance for 2 years. And they said, okay, take 2 years. And if nothing is happening by the end of 2 years, you have to go to journalism school, Columbia. And I went to Circle and Square Theater School in the in New York City. And like within a year, I had an agent. I got my SAG card because I got like two lines in a big movie. And I had, you know, I was auditioning all the time. So things were happening. And so at the end of 2 years, like, you know, things were kind of really going along. So the idea of going, you know, stopping that and, you know, doing a complete pivot was, you know, insane.
Yeah. That is such a great story. Like that you kind of just, you found it, you were into it, and then it just happened for you. You know, that's really awesome.
I got super lucky, and I emphasize the word lucky like really quickly, because I have friends who are just geniusly talented and they couldn't get an agent until they were like 32. Like they didn't get into SAG until they were 34, you know, and they're far more talented than I am. That it's just, you know, it's so much of it is being in the right place at the right time. It's a balance of luck and you do have to have talent.
Yeah. I mean, well, one of the things I really love is before we jump into all the horror questions, you were on an episode of Who's the Boss? It was your first acting job. I watched the episode. I totally remember your episode. And I just want to know, what was Tony Danza like?
Okay. I'm glad you asked me this because no one ever asks me. And I want to tell people Tony Danza was the nicest man in the world.
Wow.
Was, yeah. Oh my God. Class. He, you know, here I was, it was my first job in LA and it was just a guest spot. And I was like 22. I was, you know, so nervous and overwhelmed. And he comes right up. He shakes the hands of all the guest people, says, "Welcome to the family. We're going to have fun this week." And he treated me and the other guest people as equals. And he, on the night that we tape in front of the studio audience, a gorgeous bouquet of flowers in my dressing room from Tony Danza saying, "Thanks for doing the show."
Wow.
I'm impressed. Nice. That when you said he's the nicest, I was like, oh, he probably said hi to her, was nice. That is like over and above. That's really cool.
He's class all the way.
And he's handsome.
And he's so handsome.
You know, as we kind of pivot into Halloween 6, I first wanted to ask you, growing up, were you a fan of horror movies at all? Or did you have any horror movies that made any sort of impact on you?
No.
It's so funny. So many people, so many horror stars say that. But is it because you didn't like them? They were too scary or any particular reason?
Or they just weren't on your radar?
They kind of weren't on my radar. Weirdly enough, I do remember, you know, because Halloween 1 was such a huge success. Mm-hmm. I remember going to the movie theater. Remember movie theaters? with my older sister. And we went with her friends in high school to see Halloween. And that was like the only time I really went out of my way to see a horror movie. And that's why it's so ironic that, you know, years and years later, I ended up being in Halloween 6. Never would I have guessed. But we were terrified. Like at the end when Michael's gone and we were sitting in the car talking about it. And my sister had she was driving and she had her knees up on the steering wheel because we're all just like talking about the movie, or the older kids where I was just sitting there and her knee slipped and it hit the windshield wiper thing, and the windshield wiper started going like this, and we were screaming our heads off because we didn't know that like she had accidentally done that.
You
we
thought it was Michael Myers was coming out.
He's clearly under the car right now. And we're so effed. And
oh,
so,
you can cuss on this podcast. Please do.
yeah, that's really that movie. I really, and then later in life, like I got turned on to Rosemary's Baby, which is a big favorite of Dan Ferentz, who you're interviewing. Yeah.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And yeah, but like I never, it was never like a thing for me. And it's interesting when you do conventions, the people who come to conventions, they assume that the reason you did the movie is because you're a horror movie fan. And it's like, oh no, it was an audition.
Yeah, that I no,
had to go on. And, yeah. And I got it and I was thrilled to do it because it's money, it's a paycheck. And in this particular instance, Dan Ferentz's script was so brilliant. And the role he wrote for me was so amazing. I was just over the moon. But I didn't do it because it was like, oh, it's a horror movie. I have to only do horror movies.
Yeah,
I know. It's like random.
Well, speaking of that, because we wanted to know with Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers, which for listeners, if you're unfamiliar with the Halloween series, first off, what are you watching? But no, secondly, the sixth installment in the series. This was your feature film debut, right?
As a lead, yes.
Oh, okay. Yes. What was the audition process like for the role of Kara Strode? What did you do in the audition? How did that go?
Well, there were many auditions. Like there was the first audition, and then there was a callback, and then another callback, and then there was a chemistry read with Paul Rudd. Mm-hmm. To see if we had chemistry, because he was the number one choice and I was the number one choice. He was the number one choice for Tommy Doyle. I was the number one choice for Kara Strode. We did the chemistry read and then it was basically like, you got it. But definitely had to do the scene where I'm looking through the camera across the street and looking into my bedroom where Beth is with my brother. Mm-hmm. And I say, Beth, there's someone in the room. He's right behind you. I had to scream. They made me scream. Yeah. And Mustafa Akkad, who, God rest his soul, who's no longer with us, you know, he was the producer of the movie and the Halloween franchise. Mm-hmm. And he was always there. And he was a big supporter of me playing Kara.
Nice.
And he was such an elegant, lovely man with a real European flair. Like he wore silk ascots and cashmere sweaters and tweed blazers with these suede patches, you know, the way I like my men to dress.
I'm gonna say, Tim, that sounds like your fashion.
I totally would wear that. I would absolutely wear that. Yeah.
I love it. I just love that look. And he was very kind and warm in a very reserved way. And yeah, that was it. And apparently my audition's on the internet somewhere. And like a few years back, someone showed it to me. I was like, I can't believe I got the part wearing what I was wearing. Like I was wearing like a peasant dress with like, some random Agnes B black sweater over it. And it was just, I was like, wow, I really got that.
It was the style of the time.
Well, and it was, I feel like that's good for Kara because Kara isn't like, you know, it seems like she's not one who's like dressing risque or trying to be like, you know, that.
Well, that's what I felt. Yeah.
Yeah. And so she's seemed like a more reserved character, you know, who's not flaunting things.
Did you go back and watch the sequels after Halloween?
Yeah, when you got the part.
Yes. Okay. So what I did was when I got the part, there really wasn't a lot of time. It was like I had to be in Salt Lake City in a week. So I went to Blockbuster Video. Remember.
Of course.
And I rented number one and number two, which I had seen, but years ago. Mm-hmm. Everyone told me, skip three.
Yes.
It's not going to help you understand what's going on.
It's kind of its own thing. Yeah, it's kind of its own thing.
I listened and I skipped three and then I rented four and five. So I watched those four several times each. And that was kind of my homework, just so I know like what's going on and where we are and who's who and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine that's help. It's like doing your research on it.
So, totally.
So right off the bat, I have to applaud you on your performance because Kara, she's such a smart, caring and tough character. You know, I feel like she's the most Laurie Strode-like character of all the sequels. You know, she's always aware of her surroundings. She kind of always puts her son first, you know, and you've made her into such a likable character. So right off the bat, want to applaud your performance in this film.
Okay, that is the nicest thing anyone has ever said to me vis-a-vis Halloween 6, that I am the most Laurie Strode-like character. Thank you so much, because actually I was kind of going for that. And I think Daniel was in the writing as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's true. I mean, you really are. There's a lot of great characters in the series, but you are really the most Laurie Strode-like. You feel like she's a Laurie Strode-like character, which she's always, you know, and... So I guess I wanted to ask, did you enjoying this kind of playing this more of this maternal like character, you know, who's always putting her son first? And did people also often compare you to Laurie Strode or Jamie Lee Curtis from the first two?
Not a lot. Like you're one of the few who has compared me to Jamie Lee Curtis as Laurie Strode in the first two, which like, as I said, could not be a greater compliment. Daniel just wrote a character that was kind of very me. And so it wasn't like, I didn't have to overthink things. And I just kind of played it like me in those circumstances.
Mm-hmm. We're good friends with Daniel Ferrance, but were there a lot of script changes and different versions of the film or what?
I mean, yeah, we've heard some, but like how different was that the first, like meaning we know there's been a big evolution.
Yeah,
you know?
Like from script to screen, what did you see change? I mean, you don't have to go with like every detail, but.
Well, from the script that I auditioned with, to the theatrical release, there was like an enormous difference.
Yeah.
And then it became a big deal where I guess it was 2006, the Blu-ray version of the producer's cut came out.
Yeah.
And people thought, oh, this is what Daniel Ferrance wrote. This is like the original. No.
Yeah, that wasn't. Yeah.
Not even, I say to people, not even the producer's cut was what Daniel Ferrance wrote. I guess it was a little bit close. It was definitely closer because you had you had that whole set, the Druid set and the underground cult of the townspeople and stuff like that. But even that, there was just so many changes. You know, when you shoot a movie, things happen like weather. And so our first week there, it snowed in Salt Lake City, which even for Salt Lake City was an early snow. And so so many things had to change and schedules changed, and they had started getting behind in the schedule, and they started like kind of basically ripping pages out of the script. Like, we don't need this. We don't need that. Like a lot of my scenes, by the way. That one has to go, really?
I can't imagine poor Dan Farron's like seeing pages like just ripped out of the script. Nah, we don't need that. That must be horrible.
It was, you know, yeah, horrific. And Daniel was like my touchstone on set. Like I always go to him like, okay, so what did you intend here? And what does this mean? What does that mean? He would explain everything because, you know, he has an encyclopedic knowledge of not just Halloween movie, the Halloween genre, but the horror genre. And then at some point he left the set and he went back to LA, and I was just devastated and Paul was too, because it was like, well, who are we going to ask? Like how are we going to get guidance and advice from? And then it just, the script that Daniel wrote had a beginning, a middle, and an end. It all made sense. It was brilliant. it teed it up perfectly for Halloween 7. And then what ended up coming out in 95, the theatrical release, and then later the quote unquote producer's cut, neither one of them were exactly what, not even close to what Daniel wrote. I mean, some of it is still there, definitely the beginning parts.
You have a heavy dramatic family scene at the where you get slapped and you get like a bloody nose from the scary Bradford English, aka your father, John Strode. As a viewer, what was that like, a fun scene to film, or what, where was your mind during this?
Oh, like, this is so pretentious, but I remember we wanted to make it like the whole thing was like, let's not play this family drama like a horror movie would play a family drama. Let's play it like ordinary people. Let's play it like for real. This is a family with tension. There's domestic abuse going on here, clearly. Alcoholism. And I remember like taking it like very seriously. And now when I look back on it, I kind of do have to laugh, because moving the plot along, it really wasn't supposed to be.
I love it. It's my favorite scene. I got a couple.
He's like the worst father, husband, everything. Like, it's so funny, and I'm sure that he's supposed to be, but like, literally, he is the worst person. Lies to the family about all of them living in the Myers house. You know, like, who does that?
I just, John. You knew.
You knew the whole time. I love when you say that.
Oh my God, I'm getting goosebumps.
I know. I only see one bastard in this house.
I'm just jumping ahead. I was, you know, in six years, there were no Halloween movies. So I, of course, saw it opening night. And I remember sitting there during that scene in particular. I'm not saying my family life is like that, but I'm saying, like, I thought it was the most real, like, there were real emotions there. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. It was like, it could all happen. And it was like, oh, that's different. Like,
yeah.
I was.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, it was great. It added, it was like, why I love the character, your character. So it's such a multi-dimensional character, but that's what makes her tough. You know, she is the only person really who stands up to the father.
Yeah.
The mother is way too timid. Your brother is just kind of making jokes. So you're the only character that actually stands up to him. So, you know, it is good, but
shifting gears a little bit, I have to ask, the other lead in Halloween 6 made his feature debut film in Clueless, but we have to ask, what was it like to work with the hunk, Paul Rudd?
Okay, Paul Rudd was so, so, so much fun. And it's interesting because Paul hadn't shot Clueless yet. We were in Salt Lake City shooting Halloween, and he got a call saying he had a final callback for this movie, Clueless, that he had auditioned for. So he had to get permission to miss a day of shooting and fly back, do the final callback, and come back to our set. So we worked on it. We were always in each other's like hotel rooms, like talking about like our favorite movies and our favorite actors. And we were like, so, you know, like the intensity of like young actors, like how passionate you are about stuff. And we'd go to the Blockbuster down the street, and we'd be like, what's the theme? It's going to be all Paul Newman movies. So we'd like rent Hud and Cool Hand Luke and blah blah. So anyway, we worked on his sides for his final callback, and I gave him one note. So freaking funny anyway. And you know, he's not playing a comedic character as Tommy Doyle. And I would say to him all the time, I'm like, you're so freaking funny. You should do comedy. And so then he has this final callback. We were working on it the night before he's leaving to go fly back to LA. And he had a line that where the German writer, philosopher Nietzsche is mentioned, and everyone says Nietzsche, right? But he was playing this really pretentious kid who went to school back east, Brown and stuff, and really pretentious people say Nietzsche, not Nietzsche.
Yeah.
And I said, I promise you, if you say Nietzsche, every other actor is going to say Nietzsche. If you say Nietzsche, which is the correct German pronunciation, and you go to Brown, it's an Ivy League school, that's his character. Mm-hmm. Like you'll trust me, you'll be saying Nietzsche and you will get a laugh. And he came back and he was like, it got a laugh.
Oh.
And then he got it.
I know.
And
that is
I don't know if you know this, but he got it.
Yeah. Well, wait, I have to ask.
He's clueless, you guys.
I have to ask, did he say, oh my God, I got this movie with the girl from the Aerosmith videos?
No, it's so funny. I know. So it was interesting because Clueless came out summer of
95.
And then we had to come back to set to do reshoots in like August of 95. I'd moved back to New York. He was living in New York. We had to go back to LA, shoot this week of reshoots. But in that small period of time, he was now like the person recognized in the airport. Like he said, 14-year-old girls and gay men love me.
Hello.
That's us.
Tim and I are both 14-year-old girls and gay men.
Exactly. He was like, in airports, they're just like, vroom. And I was like, Polly, oh my God, you're famous. But it was interesting because everyone thinks like, oh, Clueless came out first and then Paul Rudd did Halloween 6. He got Halloween 6 first.
Yeah.
Then Clueless. But then Clueless came out before Halloween 6.
Do you still keep in touch with Paul at all? Or when was the last time you spoke or chatted with him?
When we became friends, we must remember this is back before social media, cell phones. You had to like have the person's phone number of their home where you would call and leave a message.
Yeah.
And then they would get the message and then they would call you back. And like now when I do stuff, you know, everyone trades information, you friend each other on Facebook and, you know, you have everyone's cell phone, you put it in your phone. So we stayed in touch for a little bit and then we like fell completely out of touch because there was just no way everyone, you know, you move. And when you move, your phone number changes. Like if you move to New York or wherever, but then we're both involved with this charity for stuttering children in New York. And so I saw him a couple of years ago. It was like 2 years ago at an event for SAY, Stuttering Association for the Young. Mm-hmm. And we just started talking and it was like no time had passed.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's great. So because it's like you have that connection, you know, doing especially both of your first, you know, lead roles, I guess, in movies, you know.
Yeah. Also, Paul's really cool because he doesn't have like a snobbery about like now that I'm a big star, I'm going to forget that I did that movie all those years ago. You know, he doesn't have that thing.
That's awesome.
That's why he's so likable.
Yeah, I know he totally. Really seems like that.
He's so likable.
And so, I mean, my favorite scene is your audition scene with the camera and everything. What's your favorite scene?
That scene.
It's a good scene. It's so suspenseful. Well,
but we also have to talk about, I have to mention your beautiful swan dive out the window toward the end. Now, I'm assuming you didn't do that yourself, but I do want to know, were you on set that day and did you have any part in that dive? Like, did you kind of lean out the window and then you were on the ground? Like, how much were you involved with that beautiful swan dive?
Okay. I have so much to say about the swan dive. I can't even. Number one, my own freaking mother. Now, obviously, the swan dive was not me flying out the window. It was a stunt double, right? But my lovely mother, who doesn't know such things, she said, oh, Marianne, and my favorite scene of yours was when you went out the window in the swan dive. And I said, that's not even me. You can tell the stunt double that that was your favorite scene in the movie. Thank you.
Thanks, Mom.
Wasn't even me. Second of all, I remember Dan and I did snicker just a little bit, like, oh yeah, everyone goes, when you jump out a window because there's a crazed old woman wielding a knife at you, you always go out in a swan dive, right? Like, we kind of made fun of it because it's like, it's just
quite
not
a jump.
It
is quite a jump.
I would have done. It would have been a little bit of a messier situation.
Of right? course.
And I had nothing to do. All I did was, I didn't go near the window. It was just like, I'm looking at the window and then I turn around and there's Mrs. Blankenship and she's like, hello, dear, with the knife. And I was like, and then I turn back and then they cut. And then they do the stunt double lady, who they do think they did an amazing match, because even I am like, oh, the hair looks the same and the outfit looks the same. It is the same outfit, but the hair especially is hard to get right, because this is my real hair. And like, usually if you just get a wig with curly red hair, it doesn't look the same, but they sprayed it with gold and they did a great job.
No, that is
great.
I love that. You know, another person we have to ask you about, because we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the late, great Donald Pleasance. And, you know, that being his final film, him being such an important part of the Halloween legacy, and you and Paul Rudd got to have scenes with him. What was he like to work with, especially at that point?
Okay. One of the reasons I was so excited about getting this part is because Donald Pleasance was in the movie. And you know, I'm, you know, he's such a magnificent actor. I mean, he takes lines that are just, you would think are throwaway lines, and he makes them Shakespeare. And we weren't supposed to know that he was ill, but we kind of figured it out, because he was in his trailer most of the time with his wife as his caretaker, and he was walking with a cane. So they had to add that, you know, into the movie, that, like, you know, he has some line about the cane, because he, Donald Pleasance, the human being, was actually walking with a cane. But he was just magnificent, and he had such an amazing sense of humor. And I, you know, when I really worship someone and I think they're like totally amazing, I can't talk around them. Like, I become mute and I am like this, and they think that I'm like rude or like cold, like I'm not being chatty and stuff, but it's just because I'm so intimidated. And I was kind of like that with him. And one day we were sitting in our director's chairs, and this was rare, he was out sitting with us. I guess we were about to shoot. And I was reading, remember the magazine Vanity Fair?
Of course.
Of course.
Thank you. So I don't feel so ancient, but you know, it was like, you know, the thing to read. It was fab. And so I'm reading, you know, Vanity Fair, and he said, what are you reading? And I hold up the magazine and I show him the cover, like Vanity Fair, and he goes, Thackeray's best. Because Thackeray wrote Vanity Fair, right?
Oh.
And I was like, I know, it's like so super inside a joke that like, it's really, you do have to like, it's the kind you get like on the elevator on the way down. You're like, oh, that was... Thackeray's best. And I was like, what? Oh, that's good. And so funny. And then the last scene of the movie, which Dan Farrens liked to call like Danny, Tommy and Marianne go off for a happy meal to McDonald's.
Yeah.
Like after all this in our Jeep. because all this stuff had mayhem had happened, but then they use a shot of us from like the first cut.
Yeah.
And you know, there's nothing like, we're not beat up or anything. And it was so freaking freezing. I've never been so cold in my life to this day. I'm 54 years old. Never in my life have I ever been so cold as I was in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Wow.
We were so cold. And so Donald Pleasance is standing outside of the passenger window where I am. And I say, you know, come with us. And he's like, no, I have some business to attend to. And during one of the, and I think I said, where are you going? And then he says, to the Bahamas. And like, they're like, cut. All right. That was funny. That was cute, Donald, but it's like 2:30 in the morning. And like, can we just wrap this up? And I was like, F you, this man is like a miracle. And that was hilarious. And that was so worth it.
Oh,
And then, yeah, it was shocking, but not shocking when I got the news that he had passed away at his chateau in the south of France, but because he did seem weak. And I did think, wow, what a way to go out. You know, you have a chateau, you know, in Port du Vence in the south of France. Like, that's where I want to go out.
Don't
me
we
too.
All? It is. It's
Halloween
so.
Halloween didn't pay me quite enough when paying double scale. I didn't quite make enough, but.
It feel as a Halloween, a huge Halloween fan, like to know that that was his last movie means something, you know, that was like kind of his last hurrah. And it's just it's so sad, but at the same time, it's like cathartic that it was by playing this character that people like myself, Tim, every horror fan grew up loving in this series.
Yeah, and
just the fact that you got to experience that final movie with him, that's so beautiful. You know what I mean?
That I feel that way too. Thank you.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I was going to ask, was there a red carpet premiere or when the movie came out or any kind of special cast and crew screening?
Okay. As far as the cast and crew screening goes, there was one in Los Angeles in the spring of 95, which we thought was that was basically the producer's cut. Okay. Oh. So we were like, okay, this is it. This is the movie. You know, even, you know, people who cared about the movie, Paul, myself, Daniel, we're not thrilled, but it was like, all right, this is it. And so much so that the costume people got rid of the costumes and, you know, we were moving on. And that was the cast and crew screening. And then that movie was going to come out in the fall to coincide with Halloween. And then Miramax did these test screenings with like 14-year-old boys who hated the movie, said there wasn't enough violence, wasn't enough gore, and the ending sucked. And I believe that was a direct quote. The ending sucked.
Oh, God.
So the Weinsteins in their, you know, wisdom decided that they were going to do reshoots. And so that's when they called us back. Over that summer, I was in New York. Paul was becoming famous because of Clueless. And he had grown his hair long. I'd cut mine. And it was like, oh, you have to go back to LA to do like 8 days of reshoots. LA, we shot it in Salt Lake City. How's it going to match? And they're like, oh, don't worry. It's not your problem. So we get there and I go for my costume fitting and I'm like, so where's like the white like dress thing? And the new costume designers are like, well, the costume designers thought the movie was locked after the cast and crew screening. So they gave away, sold or gave to Goodwill, or I don't know, whatever costume people do with costumes, and gave them away. And I'm like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Like, it was my problem, you know? And I said, so what happens now? And they're like, we're just going to try to remake them. Exactly. We're watching the movie, and I gave them guidance too. I was like, it was more of a boat neck than a ski neck.
I love
that. Wow.
You're like, can we get the neck correct, please?
The neckline really needs to match. So they had to redo the costumes completely. And it was, I think, you know, unless you're one of those those people who notice like every little thing, continuity geeks,
OCD.
OCD. I think it kind of worked because they put extensions in my hair. And Paul didn't want to cut his hair, but they cut it enough to sort of make it match. But if you look really closely, you can, the scenes shot in Salt Lake City in 94, Paul's hair is much shorter. When you see a scene where his hair has just a bit of a curl, just a tiny bit of bend, yeah, you're like, That was shot in August of 95.
I do have to ask, because, you know, I think both the endings in both cuts have pros and cons. You know, I'm not a big fan of that crazy added gore violence. You know, I'm not one of those people. It's like,
I loved
more
it.
Gore. But I will say, in the theatrical release, for in the ending, your character does get like a big fight scene where you get to beat the shit out of Michael Myers. Which ending did you prefer? Like, did you enjoy getting that extra scene with the lead pipe?
Yeah, I did. I really loved, by the way, the lead pipe that's made of styrofoam and painted.
Yes, of course, painted. Of course. With the other Michael Myers, by the way, I'm sure listeners I read about said they had a different Michael Myers during the reshoots, right? That's so crazy.
You know, you're telling me this, I didn't know.
Miramax thought that George Wilbur looked a little too pudgy in the silhouettes of him. I mean, insanity.
So they thought we're going to make sure that in the next scene, Michael Myers is slimmer and people just think he like fasted for a few hours.
And grew like 5 inches, because this guy was 6'3". Oh, wow. He was 6'3", and he was a stunt man himself, obviously. And he looks quite different from George Wilbur. George Wilbur, who I loved. I liked the other guy too. I forget it. I can't recall his name right now, but
I think it may be Michael Lern. Michael.
That's
well,
it.
Oh, he's, yeah, I saw his headshot. He's a good looking guy. He is.
He was.
Tim's and, into serial killers.
I am into serial killers.
No, he was. He was going to take me to learn how to line dance.
Oh. Would you have made him wear the Michael Myers mask during that?
No.
Oh, man.
Where were we? We're talking about...
Oh, you're ending with the lead pipe, and if you liked that versus...
You know what? I really did love that I got to get that aggression out on Michael Myers, but the theatrical release was... I mean, the ending really didn't make any sense, and it wasn't written by anybody, and it was just kind of thrown together at 2:30 in the morning, and they were on the phone with New York begging for another day, and Miramax said, nope, that's it, you have to end it tonight, that's it. And so it was like basically Paul Rudd, myself, Joe Chappelle, the director, this guy, Chris Garrity, who was the first AD, standing around trying to figure out, like, so what should we do? Oh, and then someone had this idea of like having, you know, that syringe with the green stuff, like just laying near the mask. And that's like the last scene. I mean, it was not my idea, but I just walked away because I was like, I don't even know what to say. But as Daniel will tell you, he wasn't madly in love with the ending of the producer's cut, which was the first movie, the first version we saw, which was the cast and crew screening. that everyone thought was like, okay, this is the movie. And that, so much so that like people went throwing stuff out. Oh. Like it's, I recently, for the 25th anniversary, I did a watch along, and it was of the producer's cut, which I hadn't seen since 1995 for that cast and crew screening. I never saw it, you know, I never saw it again. And the mood of it, I thought, was really, really A plus and very interesting. But because it wasn't able to be what Daniel wrote in the end, it didn't work the way I think Daniel will tell you when you interview him. It didn't work the way he thought it would work.
Yeah.
It was supposed to work because it wasn't his writing. It wasn't his script. It wasn't, you know.
No, exactly. Wow. No, there's a lot that is, that I know changed, and I can't even imagine being the writer and seeing kind of what you've written, like transform so much, you know?
Absolutely.
We did want to ask you, as we move off of Halloween 6, you know, you've been in a number of other horror films like Stakeland, Dead Calling, Breadcrumbs. And I just wanted to know, of the other horror films you've done, are there any that are your favorites or that you would recommend over others? Because we did see that in Dead Calling, you starred alongside a ton of Halloween alum, like PJ Souls, Charles Cyphers, Ellie Cornell. Like, that was just crazy. How many Halloween alums?
Can I tell you something? Dead Calling is not a movie. It does not exist. Dead Calling is a trailer. Oh. That was made by a guy named Mike Nichols, and Dean Winters and myself have tried to get it taken off of IMDb for years, and they won't. They say it's, none of those people are in it. PJ Souls was in it, but we didn't work together. It was a trailer to try to get the movie made. It's like 2 minutes long.
Oh my God.
And it's not a movie. It doesn't exist.
Oh my God. Thank you. We were wondering.
We were like, where can we find it?
We were looking all over to find this movie. And we were like, we can't find it anywhere, but there's so many cool people in it. Oh my God.
It was shot out in Long Island, like near the Hamptons. It actually was where Breadcrumbs was shot. And I just will never understand how they were able to get it put on IMDb as a feature film.
I feel duped.
Mystery solved. Thanks for telling us the truth.
Wow. Yeah. I was wondering, like, it did seem too good to be true. Yeah, there were like, so many Halloween alum, and I'm wondering, wow. Okay.
I was like, we tracked down everything. How did we miss this?
And don't you think it would have been like such a huge movie for Halloween fans to be watching? Right.
Oh my God. Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And then,
is there a favorite of your other horror movies that were actual movies?
Yes. I loved Last Kind Words with Brad Dourif.
Yes, Chucky. The voice of Chucky.
David, I of course, being of an older generation, think of him as what's his name in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, he was
nominated for an Academy Award for that.
Of course, yes.
And he is brilliant.
Also a Halloween alum, because he was Sheriff Brackett in Rob Zombie's Halloween 1 and 2.
Oh, was he really?
You know what?
I haven't seen any of the Halloweens after Halloween 6.
Wow. Not even the 2018 one with Jamie Lee Curtis?
Yeah. And I love what she's done, you know, the woman empowerment thing that she's done with Laurie Strode versus Michael, you know, like Michael represents basically all the men who have, you know, been bad boys, and, you know, Laurie Strode is like the fighter for women and the Me Too movement. Have you seen all that kind?
She seems to have really embraced Laurie Strode, and she has made it into a good tale, which I think is a good tale for, you know, for now. And it is, I will say Halloween 2018 really did, You know, it's nice to see a survivor years after they've gone through trauma, which is exactly why I would love to see Kara Strode this long after. Would you reprise the role if they ever asked you today? Like, they were like, hey, we're getting Paul Rudd. We want you back.
Yes. And like in negative second, like I was like, yes.
I love that.
I love that note too, because it is really cool to be.
I would be like, I would die.
I mean, to be such an integral character in this series and one that has survived, you know, so that it is really, really cool.
There is a man who is a huge fan and he wants to bring my character back and he's written a script for it. And we've been talking about it. And it's called Halloween, The Final Curse of Michael Myers, or The Curse of Halloween. It has two different titles. But it's been tricky because of COVID now with the Delta variant. He lives in Florida and, you know, Florida is just aflame with COVID. And I just don't know. We'll see. We'll see.
That sounds promising.
If I have bigger news about that, I will let you know.
Yes, please. We love your character. We love this series. And the thing is, what's good about the Halloween series is they can continue doing the Laurie Strode movies, which are great, but there's alternate kind of timelines in a way. And there's no reason why they can't continue Kara's timeline also.
Well, that's what he wants to do. But it'd be a very, very small independent film. I just don't know what the audience would be for it. What do you guys think?
I can say that there is a huge, well, here's the thing. Like, we as horror movie fans, people that listen to this podcast, people that love horror, they are dedicated to these series in a way that I've never seen any sort of dedication.
Yeah, and we follow it wherever it goes.
And I will say this, and as one, and I'm not bullshitting you, I promise, not just because I would love to have you do this movie. We spoke with Tom Matthews, who was in Friday the 13th, Part 6. Uh-huh. And after that movie, his character didn't continue. Well, a few years ago, a fan film was made continuing his character.
This would be.
Yes, and it was an independent film just like that. It's done really well, and they're doing three more because it has had such a great reception. So there's life for these characters after the first movie.
And I will say the fan film is beautifully shot. It looks like a theatrical release.
It generates a lot of press because it's like, oh my God, they're bringing back this character, which means appearances and people like reinvigorating that love for the character. So, I mean, from my limited point of view, that's what I can promise.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the career advice, you guys. I have no one else to ask.
No. I mean, but truly, as fans, we absolutely loved your character, your performance, and would love to see you continue the character. And we do have one final question for you. Yeah. We asked this to all of our interviewees. It's a little bit putting you on the spot, but I love those types of questions. What is one thing that you can tell us about your experience working on Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers, that you've never told any other interviewer, convention, publication, or podcaster? Just one thing that you've never told anyone.
And it could be like a small detail, like on Tuesdays we had chicken. Like it could be like so little.
Or the biggest thing, like Paul Rudd got food poisoning and threw up on Donald Pleasance.
Okay, I have something. Okay, so I told you how Paul Rudd and I would rent movies to watch at night or on our day off or something. And we had very similar tastes and humor and stuff. And there's a movie called With Nail and I. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Mm-hmm. It was George Harrison, the Beatle, George Harrison. Yeah. His movie company, he started a movie company called Handmade Films. And it was the first movie they did. It came out like in the early 80s. And Richard E. Grant is the star of it. And it is genius, right? So I said, of course you've seen With Nail and I. I'm holding it up. He's like, no. And I was like, okay, you have to see this. So one day, where I was shooting and he wasn't, he watched the movie and he came to pick me up. I rented a car and he came to pick me up from set. And I was like, so did you watch with Nell and I. And he's like, I did not like with Nell and I. I loved with Nell and I. So a year and a half later, I'm in LA and I'm reading, remember Details magazine?
Yes. Oh yeah, of course.
For men. And I'm reading it and it's an interview with Donald Logue, an actor who was like about to be something. Like he's really, really good.
I remember him.
Yeah, yeah. And Paul, and they were doing an indie film together and they bonded because they both were obsessed with the movie with Nell and I, and they could recite the movie from start to finish together. And so I'm like reading the article looking for my name, right? Like, well, I was introduced to the movie by Marianne Hagen. We were shooting Halloween. Da, 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 da. Never got credit. And I was like, the whole thing about their bromance is that they both are obsessed with Nell and I. They can recite it from first line to last line, and it's all because of me. And I don't get any credit. What?
That is awesome. Yeah. Well, you know what? You are getting that due credit right here now on Happy Horror Time, everyone.
I want it on the record. Paul Rudd only knows from with Nell and I because of Marianne Louise Hagen.
That is awesome. That is a great story.
Yes.
Well, look, we are so grateful, Marianne, that you took the time to chat with us. This has been so much fun. Yes. Seriously, for us. We've enjoyed this so much.
Honestly, I have to tell you, I was in a really low mood before we started this, and I am in the best mood right now.
Oh, good.
You guys, you're so smart. You're so funny. You're so loving. You're so delightful. You just lifted me up. And this is just like now the rest of my Sunday is just going to be wonderful. And I thank
that is, I can honestly say the sweetest thing anyone we've ever interviewed has said to us. So thank you.
True.
Thank you.
We are such big fans, such big admirers of you, and so grateful that you took the time to
do
this. Thank you so much. You've been incredible.
Yeah.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Tim. You guys are awesome. Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Well, take care. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Sunday.
Okay. Bye. Thanks for listening to Happy Horror Time. We've been having so much fun talking to the stars from the Halloween series this month. As you know, Tim and I are huge fans, and it's been such an honor and a privilege to be able to speak with Anna Alicia, Stacey Nelkin, Wendy Foxworth, and Marianne Hagen. They all are amazing, and we just love them. And we hope you have been enjoying the interviews as much as we have. Please be sure to tune in next week as we celebrate our one-year anniversary since we relaunched Happy Horror Time, and you can listen to our review of Halloween Kills. We saw the movie in theaters and rewatched it on Peacock, so we have a ton of thoughts and can't wait to share them with you. We also wanted to say thank you to Jacob, our producer and our editor, who has helped us so much along the way and has helped us make our All Halloween, All October such a great month for Happy Horror Time. It has been a dream come true, and it means a lot to us that you, the fans and the listeners, have been listening to us. We can't thank you enough. Finally, for our really dedicated listeners, or even our, you know, not so dedicated listeners, we also have a growing library of bonus episodes on our Patreon that we think you'll absolutely love. So if you'd like to support this podcast and get access to those bonus episodes and additional content, please visit patreon.com/happyhorrortime and follow us on all of our social media channels at Happy Horror Time. Thanks again for listening, and have a happy horror time.